Hey, everyone, and welcome to the Narration by George podcast, the podcast on audiobooks, spiritual ideas, and other items of interest. Today is podcast number 69, the fourth edition of Books That Go Together. Last week, we introduced you to a fellow named Danny Wilson. His story is told initially in The Sixth Lobe by Michael Miller. And if you haven't checked out his story, try listening to last week's podcast. Or better yet, get the book. There are links on my webpage for the places to buy the book. We'll talk about that in a minute. The follow-up to Danny's story is told in Born to Matter, Danny's story as an adult. In this treatise, Danny has completed his growing up years in Australia and decides to return to the States to deal with some old scores. Let's begin our peeks into this exciting book at the point where Danny tells his dad of his decision.
"Okay, what couldn't wait until morning, mate?" the father begins, noting Danny's dry glass. "Thanks for listening. I couldn't sleep again. But this time was different. I tossed and turned as usual, but after considerable agony, I finally figured out what I must do to stop this unending uneasiness. It came to me tonight that I need a drastic change in my life."
"What kind of change?" Sikorsky breathes heavily, setting the expensive Stotz Le Milano wine glass on a carved wood table next to the chair, once realizing Danny's more serious than anticipated.
"Your condition has been protected all these years, and now you want risking it on a whim?"
"It's not a whim, Dad. I need to go back to America."
"America? Why there, for heaven's sake? Aren't you happy here?"
"Of course I'm happy," Danny sighs.
"My life here has been fantastic. Getting college degrees and meeting so many nice people has restored my confidence in human beings. But happiness is not enough anymore. I have to stop hiding and get back into the hunt. I have to use the gifts God has given me to benefit more people than your boring investment clients. Besides, I feel that the Lord is truly calling me into action."
"I don't know about this decision," Sikorsky laments, ignoring the religious implications.
"It has risks we've discussed often, and they still exist. Yeah, maybe the players will change, but the results will not. And who can blame them? Would anyone understand your brain condition?"
"I doubt it, Dad. But that means I must go back better prepared. It's an inevitable war that must be waged. And why should I waste the gift?"
"When do you plan returning?"
The simple question immeasurably eases Danny's mind when realizing its insinuation, not an unintended impact by the proud parent. "Thanks for understanding."
"You're welcome, I suppose. But I'm not sure I fully understand. I realize you could do a lot of good with your unique talent, son. It's just that my life with you has been splendid, and now you're taking it away. Call me selfish, but that's my true feeling."
"I feel the same way. But duty is beckoning me to act, and you know as well as I do that my condition is being wasted on stock picks and another fancy degree.
Why not stay in Australia and work? They could use your talent here as well, if you must use it."
"Yeah, for sure. But in America I can fight bigger battles, take on tougher challenges, and make a greater impact on society. It's the land of opportunity like none other. At least, that's what I keep telling myself. Plus, I want to even the score. Besides," Danny emphasizes with a flap of his hand, "I'm born and bred to fight this war."
"I realize that now, but even what score?" Sikorsky argues, flapping his hand back like a return volley.
"Those guys are all dead, buried, or retired. I don't think you'd ever recognize anybody after this many years. Remember, you were barely 11 when we left Old Glory."
David's tone suggests he's getting riled.
"Let's not argue, Dad. I'm leaving next month after the graduation ceremony. What about me? Should I tag along or stay here?"
Sikorsky prefers staying, but makes it sound like an option, and his son's choice. Tremendous bolster to his son.
"Why, stay here, Pop, of course. I might need financial support or a safe haven once in a while. Besides, you have a great life, and your fleet of girlfriends would miss you, and Sally would hate the noise, traffic, and smog. The family pet looks up, stares at Danny, then puts her head back down after a long, sad-eyed sigh. Danny arrives back in the States, in Chicago to be precise, and sets up a private investigation agency with offices in Chicago and in Arizona. It isn't long before he acquires his first client.
Fred Rogers?
Yes, that's the company name, but please use my nickname, Danny. How can I help you, Jamie?
Thanks for calling me back. I think my phone at home is bugged, so that's why I'm calling from a payphone.
I see. Go on, ma'am. Danny leads his prospect after she pauses for signs he understands.
I realize you may be new in town, but can you assure me of your independence?
Well, I don't know if I can allay all your fears completely, ma'am. I've lived overseas for the past 15 years, if that helps. My roots are from the area just north of here, but I've no ties in Chicago.
I'm scared, but I guess I'll have to trust someone. It might as well be a perfect stranger, she begins shakily.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, Danny. Here's my story in a nutshell. My daughter works in a city office and overheard an odd conversation she was not supposed to hear. We're not sure they knew she heard them, but I'm afraid for our lives. You see, there have been lots of corruption scandals in Chicago for decades, but now it's way out of control. There are a few families who control almost everything in politics and budgets, and a couple murders in the area of late have been very suspicious.
Are these crimes under investigation? Danny presses, his bass voice reassuring Jamie.
Yes and no, she pauses significantly. I don't trust the FBI, cops, judges, and anyone associated with the mayor's office. Whoops, she sighs. That slipped out.
Don't worry, ma'am. I didn't hear anything. Please go on.
Thanks, Danny. Well, my husband was killed several years ago, but the crime was never solved. Officially, it was robbery gone wrong, but if you knew my husband, he would not have died in a holdup. It was a setup, pure and simple. I stayed in the background due to a few threatening late-night calls after my pleas fell on deaf ears. Anyway, my daughter has worked in the mayor's office for several years, maybe kind of payback in hindsight for the grief my family has endured.
What'd your husband do for a living?
Cook County detective, Danny, and a damn good one.
I see. Why do you suspect premeditation?
Because Joey, my husband, told me he was investigating a high-ranking official and wanted me to know if anything happened to him. He'd been set up, that's why, she explains, painfully recalling her husband's words while in bed with him near the end of his life.
Yes, those words would be worth believing, ma'am. You're right to trust what he said. Psychological profiles support these kinds of admissions, as ironclad in my world. Plus, your home may be bugged.
Oh, my Lord, I hope not, but I appreciate your advice. That's the first time I've had any worthwhile support from anybody other than my closest friends.
No problem, Jamie. All right, what would you like me to do? Danny follows, assuming nothing but predicting the worst.
Help us, I guess. I'm not sure how, but I suspect we're about to have an accident. It's an eerie feeling I have in my gut, and I believe my husband was set up and murdered.
Danny pauses briefly. Okay, I can be in Chicago by noon tomorrow, but I suggest you collect your daughter and leave town before then. Take a mini vacation, or I have a contact across the state line who can house you until I have time to nose about.
Won't that raise suspicions if they don't know?
I'm glad you're thinking clearly, and most likely it will. But the alternative risk, as you stated, is a little more permanent, ma'am. It's your choice. You hold the dice.
Let me think about it, Danny. That's a huge step. Can I leave a message by this time tomorrow in your cell if we go that route?
Of course. But don't talk to anyone about this, not friends or anyone.
Tell your daughter to take a sick day or two and possibly stay at a hotel in the suburbs. And don't use your credit card. Pay cash.
Good ideas. I will. Thanks, and I'll call either way tomorrow. Conceivably, I'm overreacting.
Perhaps, ma'am, but I suspect you're correct in being safe rather than sorry. How do I reach you?
Let me call you back, Danny.
Okay. Goodbye for now, and don't trust anyone until we talk again, ma'am.
Danny hangs up, puzzling over next steps. Meanwhile, other plot lines are developing. The government is really interested in Danny. You see, he and his father have developed a code which they use for communication. Fearing that this might be an ominous business, the government is trying to figure out the cipher and figure out who Danny and his dad are.
If you will please open your binders, I'd like to summarize findings on the file in front of you. Dowden begins, feeling confident he's prepared the contents sequence and details as required by the rigid no-nonsense committee. You can read as we go along, but I will hit the highlights in case key points are overlooked. The situation appears to be moving rapidly, so I'll ask at the end for your approval to invoke assets. The first section is a recap of the contents and page numbers, Dowden says, flipping a button to show his first slide in flush desk monitors mounted and tilting toward seat occupants.
Nothing new about that, Director Todd chimes.
Okay, everyone, we have two white male suspects, likely related, one in Cairns, Australia, and the other in Chicago. We've intercepted a few emails sent from libraries and coffee shops containing ciphered project plans and strange sign-offs. The plan has been edited a few times, and our folks think the execution stage has commenced. This pair is well-financed, with new offices in Chicago and Scottsdale. Later you'll see a request for the phone records of the cell numbers listed at the bottom of the page in this first section. A copy of the passport used to enter the States a couple of weeks ago is shown as well. Pictures of each man are in the attachment, Dowden adds.
All appears in order, Director Todd notes. If no objections, phone records are approved. Keep going.
Just a minute, an old manager sitting at the table pipes up. These two mugs are not blood kin. I'm not a forensic specialist, but the bone structures, eyes, and hair don't add up to father and son. You said they were related?
Yes, sir. We guess that as well, but we can't find any adoption records. The next section, Section 2, provides a couple of examples of the encryption found in the documents they've exchanged. Note in red circles a couple of exchanges in status we think refer to two American citizens, Dowden explains. Their pictures and a new clip are behind this page. The women, a mother and daughter, are now deceased, dying in a fire at their home in Libertyville, a Chicago suburb. It was definitely arson. Chicago police are mum right now, but the FBI says our arsonist used a sophisticated incendiary device. Director Todd asks Dowden to wait as he peruses the material a bit longer.
You think our younger male subject, Daniel Sikorsky, is our arsonist?
Todd asked half a minute later while comparing the two Sikorsky photos and accepting the conclusion they are unrelated.
We have no reason to believe that at this point, Dowden assures, but these people are linked in some way for sure.
It appears we have a reasonable basis for thinking that. Was the target the mother, daughter, or both?
No way yet to be definitive, but our suspicion is both. The daughter worked in City Hall, and the mother was retired, with plenty of insurance money. Also, the daughter had her own house, but was staying overnight with the mother. Odds of that being on the same night as the fire are slim. Her husband, a Chicago detective, was murdered a couple of years ago under suspicious circumstances. Dowden spends the next 20 minutes covering more intelligence, potential leads, logic, and paths they want to pursue. He covers scanty details from newspaper clips written by Racine, Wisconsin reporter James Bradley, police reports, and the sudden stoppage of noted psychiatrist Dr. Jane Brown's world tours about the same time.
Dowden makes this case ending with two items he thinks deserve special Signet attention. "These last two sections came in late yesterday," he amplifies. "The first is an unauthorized background of MPSS, National Protection Security Services, agent Richard Ricks, killed in the line of duty about 15 years ago. We have reason to believe he knew our two subjects. The second is a review of sealed records for psychiatrist Brown we borrowed from the FBI. One Signet committee member asks a question before Director Todd replies to Dowden about his request. The elderly woman pulls down wire-rimmed glasses and looks over them at Dowden with traces of disgust.
What do you mean, unauthorized?
The normally silent Signet female member asks softly, but with an obvious measure of disdain. Dowden twists his neck a bit. One of Bill Cody's pals, ma'am.
I see.
She squints, leaving hints of skepticism dangling. Another panel member jumps, deflecting attention in a timely manner as an implicit show of support for Dowden.
You know, she begins, looking at the group, I knew Jane Brown's father way back when I was a student. He was a psychiatrist as well. In fact, I met his daughter years ago when she was still in school. If you want, Bob, I can ask around and see if my old contacts know anything useful.
Thanks, Elaine. Any help is appreciated, Dowden agrees, and glad the topic had shifted to a more proactive stance. There may be links between Dr. Brown and these subjects that go back many years. If Brown was involved, I'd surmise some kind of mental disorder for the kit, most likely. Couple that with mob involvement, the scene reporter James Bradley and Sikorsky's sudden reemergence, we could catch a break.
What's important about Agent Ricks? Director Todd breaks in.
Ricks was killed in a gun battle in the middle of the day in a suburb near D.C. by crime boss Antonio Gambino. Our contact says he was protecting a young child with special skills. Apparently, Ricks killed quite a few foot soldiers that day, so he was obviously committed like a hog at a country-style breakfast. The kid had something wrong with his brain, a mutation or some kind of adaptation that made him extremely valuable to Uncle Sam. Anyway, Gambino killed the agent, his team, and nabbed the boy in a huge gunfight smack dab in the middle of the day in a residential neighborhood in Maryland.
What happened to the kid? Director Todd prompts.
Not sure of all the details, but another crime boss took on Gambino's goons in their Miami backyard, literally, so to speak, as they fought over the child. Police reports say it was an unbelievable and brazen attack from air, land, and sea. Patton would have been proud.
Well, then, who got the kid?
Director Todd pipes up, though irritated by the needless color. Beats me, Dowden grimaces. But we think our Daniel Sikorsky is the same person.
Danny's investigation into his first client's situation results in some interesting confrontation.
As Danny pulls into his underground office space, thoughts focus on the information he'll share and glean from Ned Grimes, the FBI agent expected to arrive about 3 p.m., Once outside the Mustang, he tosses his gray tweed sports coat atop his broad shoulder and heads toward the steps leading up to the first floor, opting to avoid the elevator at the other end. Nearing the banister of the staircase, three shadows appear from behind a panel van and cut off his path. The shortest thug, carrying a softball bat, steps in front as the other two husky men wait for orders. Danny attempts to pass around, but is rebuked as the leader tosses a cigarette aside and smashes it, too close for comfort.
"We're here to deliver a message, Mr. Sikorsky,"
the leader begins with a friendly, uneducated tone, keeping the bat at his side, though plainly visible.
"Is that right?"
Danny replies, immediately getting the direction this interview would ultimately lead.
"That's right,"
the leader barks, putting an index finger in Danny's chest as a first overt sign of provocation.
"My boss wants you to stop investigating the murder at Jamie Miller."
"You said Jamie Miller, not Jane?"
Sikorsky asks, realizing the death of Jane, the daughter, was likely collateral damage, though uncharacteristically sleeping at her mother's so they could escape together the next day, as Danny advised. That thought raises his ire while staring at the thugs in full control of emotions and fears up to this point. My advice killed the daughter, he reckons privately. It wasn't emphatic enough.
You heard me correct, boy. Are you deaf?
Okay. You nice fellas delivered what you're supposed to tell me, so be good little lads and leave quietly before we need a couple of ambulances down here.
Tell you what, you cocky smartass, we'll leave a cell phone so when you wake up from your nightmare, you can call one. In fact, we'll leave one hand unbroken so you can dial 911. Teach him a lesson, boys!
The leader commands, standing back to give his brutes more room as they prepare to deliver the communication more emphatically. Danny is purposeful, almost relaxed, considering his dire predicament, rejecting the use of his weapon to keep matters less complicated. Instead of cold, sweaty palms and horrors the vast majority of victims would have, his thoughts move briefly to the bullies at his high school near Cairns, Australia, and in Racine, Wisconsin, when he was a timid, skinny youth. Now prepared beyond what he then realized might be needed or useful, close-order combat is a skill his adopted father insisted upon once both settled on the idea of Danny becoming a private detective and using his unusual gift as a silent public servant. Many years of well-rounded lessons included those by a Brazilian jiu-jitsu instructor, an American boxing trainer, and an ex-Navy SEAL. As the two unsuspecting lackeys approach, looking menacing and fierce, Danny deftly ponders the pain he reasons is appropriate. Mumbling, he says, "Thanks, Eddie," a memento to the retired Navy SEAL and eventual friend his father arranged as a special in-home tutor. His closest attacker reels almost instantly when a quick flick of Danny's right arm, employing an extended spear hand, strikes the bulky assistant across the bridge of his nose with aching force. The stocky gangster, grabbing his bleeding face, is stunned and teary-eyed by the blunt force as his felonious mates check if he's still in the game. Before realizing the extent of the teammate's structural damage, Danny hits the second attacker across the throat and kicks his legs out from under him. The heavy-set man, about 285 pounds, based on Danny's accurate estimate, smacks the cement like a sack of discarded flour. As the second bully grabs his throat, gasping for oxygen, the leader is acutely awed at what happened in a matter of seconds directly in front of him. When the stupefied leader lifts the bat and begins to engage, Danny kicks the bat free with his foot and punishes the leader with a heavy fist across the side of his head. Finally, he shoves him down to the cement floor, dropping him to the ground like a ballerina, then locking him with an armbar reinforced with his powerful legs. Danny twists his body and bends the leader's arm back, jiu-jitsu style, until the hapless thug is begging for relief.
"Holy Mother of Mercy! Stop! Please stop, you crazy bastard! My arm is breaking!"
"It only feels that way right now, tough guy. Who paid for the soiree?" Danny snorts with an additional twist.
"Go to hell!"
the sweaty leader manages ruefully, wishing he could tell. "You first," Danny allows, pulling a lot harder until hearing tendon snap. "I know anyway, bozo. You tell Mr. Rossi that I expect better competition in the future. Do you hear me, greaseball?" The man winces and reluctantly shakes his beady, wet face as Danny lets go, stands up, dusts off his pants, retrieves his sports coat lying on the ground near the stairwell. Resolved the men are no longer in need of further lessons, he locates their handguns, knives, and cell phones, then dumps all but one phone into a garbage disposal compressor near the large garage door. Before climbing the stairs, Danny places the last cell phone on the leader's heaving, sweaty shirt, who begrudgingly nods his gratitude to a perturbed victor.
We've been listening to excerpts from Michael Miller's Born to Matter, the second of the books in this exciting story of Danny Wilson. Again, author Michael Miller effectively sets up the conflict, which he effectively also resolves before the end of the book. You have to listen to find out how the government and the mob roles all play out. It's another exciting end to the book, I promise. Both of these books are available through iTunes and in Audible and Amazon's stores. You can find the links on my website, narrationbygeorge.com/books. At the top of the page, you'll find icons for both of these books. Click the icon to listen to other samples from the book and find the links for purchasing the audiobooks. I'd love to hear from you. You can contact me by clicking the Contact Me link on my website, narrationbygeorge.com, or if you prefer, write to me on Facebook or Twitter. On Facebook, I'm Narration by George. On Twitter, I am at Narration by Geo. Don't forget to like the Facebook page when you get there, or you can follow me on Twitter. I do follow back. Well, that's all for this week's Narration by George podcast, the podcast on audiobooks, spiritual ideas, and other items of interest. Join me again next Wednesday when this podcast will be again new. In the meantime, God has blessed you. Share that blessing with someone else.